as I wait, heart of God.
Hello and welcome to the Bridge Podcast, where we discuss how you can bridge what we learned on Sunday with your everyday life. We do so by going through a number of questions which focus on the passage that Jonathan preached on Sunday, and we kind of dig in those a little bit closer. So this week we are in Luke chapter 9, and Jonathan has ascribed the title for this chapter as More Lessons. The disciples just get lessons upon lessons, which is great, and so do we. So more lessons. What was kind of your thought with regard to that title and perhaps the chapter as a whole? Luke chapter 9. It's a long one.
It's one of the longest chapters, and so I'm just reaching for my Bible. I freely admit that as I've said this about other chapters, I didn't deal with the whole chapter verse by verse, but it certainly very much struck me that Luke had told all of the incidents that we looked at last week about, and I think the disciples must have been very surprised, I think, when Jesus suddenly calls them together and says, okay, now's your chance. You can have it. Yeah. Now you're going to do it for yourself. And it was interesting. And so I just see the way that Jesus, then they come back and they then have a whole series of things which continue to push them in the direction we get a little moment in Jesus's ministry in the middle of this chapter when he asks the $10,000 question, who am I? Who do people say I am, and who do you say I am? And then it's in a sense that point, and I think that Jesus sets his face towards Jerusalem. You know, in a sense,
so important.
That is such an important moment that the disciples, I don't think, have any idea of its significance, but Jesus sets his face towards Jerusalem because now, in a sense, the cross is, in a sense, in front of him. And so I think that there's almost a sense in which the lessons that Jesus is teaching his disciples get more urgent. I don't know exactly what I would point to that feeling, but I feel like Jesus is getting that teaching them is becoming even more urgent for him.
Right. And of course, it's this chapter as well where he begins to teach his disciples that he will go to the cross.
Yes.
Yeah. This comes up in our second or third question. It's been 2.5 years of Jesus's ministry. He hasn't mentioned his death once. And now he finally begins to do so. But before we jump into some of that, let's kind of spin the wheel back a little bit and get to the beginning of our question. So back by popular demand is a question that we've entitled Close Reading, which is an opportunity for those who are tracking with us in this series to read through the chapter themselves and to kind of plunge its depths on their own, ask questions of the text, and see what the Lord is speaking to them through it, kind of personally. And I think that's a good way to start any study of any chapter of the Bible. So let me just read through this quickly, and then we can move on to our next question. So just a reminder of what you guys will be up to this week. After praying for God to enlighten your mind, I use the word skim because it is a very long chapter. Skim or read through Luke chapter 9. Look for these three things. Light bulb moments, that is something that shines out from the passage or draws your attention, captures your attention for some reason. Look secondly for what we're calling question marks, something that is difficult for you to understand. And thirdly, if for an arrow, which we're using to symbolize a personal application which you can draw from the text. And then share those results with your group, if you're part of a growth group. And if you're not, we of course encourage you to do that. And you can track down those groups either by sending me an email, or you can just go on our website or the Fancy Dancy phone app too, which is awesome.
Yes, I mean, I think this is really important because Chuck Swindoll says this about preaching. He said the purpose of preaching is not simply to teach people things. It's to teach them to feed themselves. Mm-hmm. And this particular question is a real way in which we can learn to feed ourselves and begin to feed on Scripture. And, you know, that's how we grow as Christians, that we feed by coming together and having these discussions, but we also feed by doing these things for ourselves. And it also gives you an opportunity to engage with things that I may not have. I mean, as you just said, David, chapter 9 is a very long chapter, and we are looking at chapter 9 from we're looking at all of the chapters from a particular perspective. That means that there are things in there that I miss. There are things that I don't talk about, but maybe you want to talk about them. And so this is a great opportunity for you to do that. And, you know, when we started this whole growth group program, we wanted it to be primarily a framework which enabled you to engage in Scripture together rather than four questions that you have to answer. Mm-hmm. So take some flexibility, take the opportunity to relax and engage with the Scripture together. I hope this question question which we've just brought back from the we for a long while we had that every week. Now we brought it back. We hope that question will help you to do that.
And if our Tuesday group is any sign of what other groups are like, we'll probably spend all the time on this question and have about 10 minutes for the next three. Well, but let's get to those next three, and that's fine. That's okay, isn't it?
Yeah, I did that. I that's perfectly fine. That's, you know, people do things differently, and that's one of the joys of it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, our second question then is titled "The 12 Sent to Ask One Question." Who do you say that I am? Jesus sent out his 12 disciples to ask Israel this very question. It's important for us to examine both how Israel answered that question and how the disciples asked it. How did the manner of the disciples' mission impact their message? How did Herod, the crowds, and Peter answer the above question? How would you answer that question? Use Peter's response as a starting point.
I don't think we realize just how important this question is very often. I certainly didn't. I think that, you know, we, in a sense, we think we know the answer to this question. And on the surface, we do. But then I think the answer to the, then I think that the, what we really need to do if we're actually engaging with the answer is to say, well, if that's true, what implication does that have for my life? Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the things that Jesus is about to tell them, and it's the subject of our next question, but it reframes what Peter said, you're the Messiah. But what did Peter mean by that? And what difference did he think it was going to make to their lives? And it's, I think that the exciting thing about this study of Luke is to see the process by which the disciples begin to understand this, mm-hmm. and to recognize that for us too, to understand the significance of who Jesus is a growing process, and moment by moment we get more and more understanding of who Jesus is, and if that is who he is, what implication does that have for our lives?
Mm.
What difference does it make if he is the Messiah?
Right. What is the Old Testament? How does the Old Testament describe the identity of this Messiah and his role? And
we know
the relationship between all people and that ruling king.
Right. And we know that they had anticipations about what the Messiah was going to be like, what he was going to do. And it was nothing like what Jesus actually was going to do.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I realized as well about this particular question, who do you say that I am? Jesus begins by asking, who do the crowds say that I am? Implying that the disciples had some kind of knowledge of how the crowds would respond to that question. And I think it's no surprise that this question on Jesus' lips follows his sending out of the 12 to proclaim that message. And then, of course, immediately before this passage, Jesus feeds the 5,000, in which he's sending out his disciples again amongst the crowds to both pass out the bread and then to gather the leftovers as well. So the disciples are among the crowds, discerning how the crowds answer this question, and then they're able to feed that response to Jesus. But it's interesting as well, this question of who I am comes up earlier as well with Herod. And Herod almost supplies the same answer that the crowd...
Herod is asking the same question.
Yeah.
So many times, when you actually really think about it, it is this question that is absolutely pivotal to our walk with Jesus. Who are we walking with? Is he just a prophet? Is he just a great teacher? All of those sorts of things, which some people believe. He's all of those things, but he's so much more. And they're only just beginning to understand that. And so Jesus has got...
Sorry there, I lost you for just 1 second, but I think it's a good time for us to move on to our third question. A bit of bad news. Jesus went 2.5 years through his ministry without mentioning his death once. Now, with only a year left to live, Jesus teaches his disciples for the first time that he must go to the cross. Place yourself in the disciples' shoes. How would you respond to this news? Does this help explain the necessity of the transfiguration following immediately after this foretelling? Can you recall a word or a moment of encouragement following a piece of bad news?
Yes, I think that's a great question, because I think that I don't think I've ever so consciously as I have done as I prepared this message, connected these different things together. And of course, that's one of the things that Luke does so well, is he tells things in a way that enables you to connect them, as opposed to seeing connect their significance as opposed to necessarily their chronological significance. Luke has that phrase where he says one day. He uses it 18 times in his gospel, because you say, okay, one day this happened, and then one day this happened, and then one day this happened. And then you suddenly realize, okay, so why he told those three incidents like this is because they build on each other. They're significant to one another.
And I think in this particular case, in all of the synoptic gospels, which mention the transfiguration, it comes immediately after Jesus's first foretelling of his death. So we can probably have a pretty good certainty of the chronology of at least these.
Yes, and because the connection is there, and there's sort of there's the two what do they call it, a chiasma, where you've got between Jesus, between Paul, Peter saying you are the Christ, the Son of the Living God, or whatever, and then God speaking and saying this is my Son. So you've got the two affirmations of who he is with the transfiguration and the prediction of his death in between. And I, you know, I just think that their heads, that the disciples' heads must have been exploding here.
Yeah.
So much information is coming at them. And I think that much of it they probably absorbed and didn't really sort of think through until much later, perhaps, in their in the process. Because Jesus tells them, has to tell them repeatedly, by the way, I'm just reminding you, I am going to suffer. And definitely,
And if we bring in the Gospel of John into this chronology as well, and how he describes the feeding of the 5,000, he actually sees it as kind of a negative event, in which, this is in John chapter 6, he says, like, why did you come and follow after me? Was it merely to eat some food or something like that? And then he says, like, I am the bread of life, and you must eat my flesh and drink my blood to have life. And then it says that many people left him. And of course, there's a conversation with Peter in which Peter says, you know, I'm not going to leave you. You have the words of life. But like, it's this moment in Jesus' ministry in which he delivers a hard saying and then people leave him. So that's there was probably a moment of tension even within the 12, and the transfiguration was able to supply them with, you know, a certain amount of reassurance.
Yes.
After this difficult word from Jesus.
In our context, there are some things which Jesus says which are hard. And it's easy to walk away because of the things that Jesus says that are hard. I mean, Jesus doesn't avoid the difficult issues.
Mm-hmm.
And confronting the reality of suffering is so important.
Yeah. And that's what our final question is about. It's addresses the fact that the suffering will not just be for the Messiah, but for his followers, at least in particular context. That's why we've entitled this last question, Count the Cost. The hits keep coming for the disciples. Not only is their rabbi headed for the cross, but they too are told they must deny themselves and take up their cross. Read the following passages to journey with the disciples in their growing knowledge of what that meant. How is it that those who are forced to count the costs exhibit so much joy? How can you do the same? And
I think
that question about joy is kind of explained a little bit by a couple of the references that we've included there for you. We've included quite a few. In Acts, it says that once, I think it's Peter and John were beaten in the council after sharing the gospel and told, don't share this message anymore. What do they do? It says that they left the presence of the council rejoicing that they were counted worthy to suffer dishonor for the name. And then in Philippians, just to mention one more passage. Let's see. For it is granted to you that you may, let me just read it explicitly instead of trying to like summarize it as I read it. For it has been granted to you that for the sake of Christ, you should not only believe in him, but also suffer for his sake. And then Paul will go on in the next chapter describing like that suffering for Jesus' sake is one of the ways in which he can know him most intimately.
Yes, because suffering was so much a feature of Jesus' life that when we are called to suffer, there's a very special way in which we identify with him. I mean, it's true of our human lives and friendships and relationships. When we experience suffering together, it builds a very special bond.
Mm-hmm.
That bond is almost, it's indescribable. You can't really define it. But when you have suffered with somebody, you know, even if you've walked up a mountain with somebody when it was really hard to get to the top, there's a sense of bonding on that achievement. I mean, and that of course there's no relationship to what we're talking about here other than to say the principle is there that as we suffer and we as we recognize, and when we looked at the whole subject of suffering, as we look at the fact that Jesus suffered so much, and we are able to just experience a little bit of that together with him, joy is not running around with a big smile on your face. Joy is something that's deep, that's a sense of deep down rightness. Mm-hmm. And I think we get that when
it's
like, okay, yeah. I must have done something right.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, joy should always result from, you know, the personal deep conviction that you know that you're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
And oftentimes you're punished for that. And the scriptures makes that pretty plain. But to know that in doing the right thing and suffering for it, you have a fellowship with Christ who went before you doing the same thing. I'm sure that God shows up in special ways personally for those individuals who are called to that. Okay, well, this wraps up our discussion of Luke chapter 9. Next week, we're going to be in Luke 10. And surprise, surprise, Jesus is going to send out his disciples again.
Yep. And he's going to send out other disciples this time.
It's going to be a big old gospel sharing party. Okay, well, we are looking forward to that party next week, and we will see you then.
As I wait, heart of God.